Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining our second donor call of 2016. We've got a really great panel on today, critical thinking on abolitionist strategy, and we're going to be digging into how critical resistance and some of our closest folks in the movement historically have advanced a common sense in which the key to health and safety is not the prison-industrial complex, is not aggression, policing, imprisonment, but healing, stability, liberation, and resources that make those practices, those things possible. And so these donor calls are an opportunity for us to appreciate the grassroots folks who make our organization and this campaign and advancing this common sense possible, this campaign work rather, apologies. Because we're 65% grassroots funded, we couldn't do this without the individual gifts that everyone brings to critical resistance. So today we'll be speaking for an hour with some of our great featured guests. We've got Craig Gilmore, Lorraine Halinka-Malko, and Melissa Birch moderating. We're not sure if Dolores Canales is going to be joining us, but if she pings in, we will welcome her into the panel. And so just a note that this call is being recorded so it can be shared with folks after today. If you are able to put yourself on mute when you're not speaking, that would be much appreciated. And the format of the call is we'll be doing about 30 to 40 minutes of discussion, probably closer to 40, discussion on the topics moderated by Melissa with our featured speakers, and then opening it up to questions. So if there are things that are particularly interesting to you or something that's been burning in your mind from a local project or campaign that you're working on, or something in the past that you would love to reflect on with some fellow abolitionists, please do raise that in the question and answer section. And then lastly, before I pass it off to Melissa, this is our mid-year fundraising season. We're looking to raise some resources to help keep this work going this month through July 15th. And you'll be receiving some emails, probably even a poster, a newsletter in the mail. And so if you can make a contribution to CR in this time, we really appreciate the resources, and it will go towards making more of these calls happen, continuing to fight prison, jail expansion, and the power of policing. So please make a gift if you can. And without further ado, I'll pass it over to Melissa.
All right. Good morning, everyone. So I am Melissa. I have been an organizer with CR for a while, starting back in 2000 around the CR South organizing in New Orleans, and then later in Los Angeles, where I overlapped for a few years with Craig around fighting the jail expansion there. And I'm now a supporter living in Austin, Texas, and I'm very happy to be facilitating this morning. And maybe Craig and Lorraine, you can go ahead and introduce yourselves. You want to start, Lorraine?
Oh, sure. Hi, I'm Lorraine Halinka-Malko, and I'm a coordinating member of a group called Transforming Justice, which is a collaborative effort of university faculty, a filmmaker, youth, and other community members to document and really invigorate grassroots resistance to mass criminalization and mass imprisonment in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which has the dubious recognition of having, like, the worst rates of black male incarceration in the country. We also had a common desire to reframe dominant narratives and police agendas on crime, policing, violence, and community health in Milwaukee. And as an outgrowth of that work, During the past year, I've organized with other educators, community members, parents, and youth to successfully halt the implementation of a pro-police curriculum, which I'll talk about a little bit more as we go on, and that was implemented in Milwaukee Public Schools. And then I'm also a faculty member at the Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I'm really glad to be able to participate in this call today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Craig? Hi, everyone. Hi. I'm Craig Gilmore. I was born in Los Angeles and have lived most of my life in California, although now I divide my time between New York and Lisbon. When we moved to New York, I had the dubious distinction of living in two cities in which William Bratton was my chief of police. My current political scheming has mostly to do with how to get rid of him and shrink, if not abolish, in the short term abolish, the New York Police Department. But I started doing work around the criminal justice system in Los Angeles in the summer of 92 in the wake of the LA rebellion, and then got seriously into it in the late 90s, spurred on by the first critical resistance conference and the Delano 2 campaign, which we'll be talking about later in the call.
Wonderful. Thank you, Craig. Has Dolores joined us by chance? No. Okay. So as just outlined, our goal for this morning's conversation is to kind of tease out some of the strategic details of what it looks like to organize against the PIC. And as we know, this kind of organizing, which Lorraine and Craig will help us discuss, often involves multiple strategies, right? So some combination of grassroots mobilization, of work with the media, of legislative or legal pressure. And so I want to begin the conversation by inviting both of the panelists to reflect on the strategies that were most important or that are most important in their respective campaigns, and kind of how they used those strategies to shift common sense. So specifically, if each of the speakers could start by sketching us a picture of the various strategies that were used or that you are still using through the course of this campaign that you're discussing today, and, you know, and kind of teasing out each of those pieces. So how, when, and why did you use grassroots mobilization, media, legislative, or legal strategies, and kind of emphasizing along the way which of those strategies was most, which of those strategies or strategy or multiple strategies were most important in that campaign. Sound good?
Yep.
Sure. Craig,
right.
You want to start?
Okay.
Sure, I'll start. So in 1999, Gray Davis was elected governor of California and immediately announced that he was going to build a new prison in Delano. California had built about 20 prisons in the past 15 years. And soon after the Critical Resistance Conference of 98, a number of us thought that we might be able to stop him from expanding the prison system. So that campaign took on a number of different avenues. One was a challenge of the environmental review that was required of a project of this size in California. So Critical Resistance and two other organizations sued the Department of Corrections under the California Environmental Quality Act, claiming that the environmental review had been insufficient. And we won that case, and the state had to redo its environmental review, open it up for public comment again. The opening of it for public comment became an opportunity for us to bring all kinds of support to our campaign to stop the prison, to comment on it. And it also opened up, I mean, the Department of Corrections did things which were just, they just handed us presents periodically. So for example, the environmental review was about 1,000 pages long. And and it was in English, and Delano, California, is majority Spanish speaking. So we asked that the EIR be translated into Spanish, and they put in writing that it couldn't be translated into Spanish because it was it had scientific terms in it. And then once we embarrassed them with that, they did a 10-page summary of it in Spanish. So we were able to walk around the state of California with the 1,000-page English version and the 10-page Spanish version and show people, you know, what the Department of Corrections thought about the input from people in the Central Valley where most of the prisons in California had been built. So that leads to kind of one of the innovative things we did in the campaign was we focused a lot of our energy on Delano and on other towns in which prisons had been built. Our strategy was to identify a number of different sorts of groups of people in California who were harmed by prison construction. Obviously, the people in the prison are harmed. Obviously, their families are harmed. But there had been very little discussion about who else was harmed. So we had enough data to know that prison towns actually suffer because the prisons are there. And we could do a lot of, because the lawsuit drew the prison construction out for a few years, we had a lot of time to do organizing in the Central Valley. We worked through environmental justice groups that were used to organizing low-income people with modest formal educations to talk publicly about sometimes very technical scientific things. We kind of used that model to go in and organize local residents to stand up against the prison. There was some danger in that a lot of them depended on local agribusiness both for jobs and for housing. And so people lost their jobs and lost housing because they spoke out against the prison. So we tried to organize on behalf of those people. And then we also were approached by some public school teachers in Oakland and Berkeley who wanted to set up an organization to fight prison expansion and fight cuts to the public education budget. So that organization became Education Not Incarceration. We did a big rally in Sacramento in which elementary and secondary school students visited every legislator in California asking them why the state had just laid off 30,000 teachers but was planning to build a $250 million prison instead. And a year after that, we did a lot of outreach to the University of California, California State University, and the community college system through their student associations, their system-wide student associations. And there was a year in 2002 or 3, I think, when the fees of the community college system were raised by 50%, and the chancellor of the community college system pointed out that that was going to drive 100,000 people out of California community colleges. 100,000 students wouldn't be able to afford to go to college anymore. And that fee increase didn't actually increase the budget of the community college system. What it did was allow the state to take money from that had been going from the general fund, funding the community colleges, pull that money out, and that money went into the corrections department. So we were, rather than try to organize, for example, our own mass mobilizations, we would march with the community college students, faculty, and staff on their annual lobby day in Sacramento. We would march with the University of California. We marched with the SEIU, who was is the biggest union in the state and represents all the workers in the prison except the prison guards. And they actually signed on to the campaign. Even though they represent prison workers, they signed on to oppose Delano II. So we marched with them. So we did very little grassroots mobilization of our own and quite a bit of tagging on to other people and people's bigger mobilizations and helping them with their messaging. And then we did a big media campaign in which we managed by 2002 to get all the major papers in the state to come out to editorialize against the building of the prison. And I can go into more detail about that if you want, but I'll stop there.
Great. We're going to turn it over to Lorraine for, there were a bunch of dings. So for people just joining, just a reminder to mute yourself if you're not talking. And the question on the table is just getting our panelists to talk about, to tease out some of the various strategies that they used in the course of their campaign and talk about which of the strategies was most important.
Okay, so let me just give you a little bit of background about the STOP program. So the STOP program stands for Students Talking It Over with Police. It's a pro-police curriculum begun in August of 2010. It was developed by a Milwaukee police officer in concert with others. And it was implemented in Milwaukee public schools and in Milwaukee's charter and private schools. By spring of 2015, over 700 students had completed the program before the elected school board had suspended the program. And that was suspended in July of 2015, and certainly in large part due to our efforts. The program was delivered by uniformed police officers in the schools. Students were taken out of their classrooms and brought to another classroom where they were educated, supposedly, by these police officers. Usually without any other educators in the room. Most often, there was no parental consent provided for the students to participate. The Milwaukee Chief of Police was responsible, as I said, for promoting the program. It was supposedly designed to establish positive relationships between Milwaukee police and so-called young leaders in the community. In actuality, any critical analysis of the curriculum demonstrates it was clearly designed to indoctrinate youth to view themselves, their peers, crime, safety, and policing all through the eyes and minds of police. So the STOP curriculum teaches youth that racial profiling, of course they didn't use those words, is necessary for the community's safety. And it was so egregious that the curriculum actually involved role plays where uniformed officers wearing guns pretended to shoot at a student in the classroom. So in case I haven't given you enough about how egregious this curriculum was, the program conditioned children or youth to be stopped regardless of whether they had done anything wrong and basically to waive their civil liberties. So we used a variety of tactics. One of the, I think, most successful things we did was we held a community workshop which we promoted through social media. The workshop was attended by a very diverse group of educators, parents, community members, and several, like 8 or 10 youth. And what we did is we actually workshopped the curriculum. We took the teacher's manual, which we had gotten a hold of, and we split it into sections, and we workshopped it. We critically analyzed the curriculum. The youth were the primary recorders and the people who were doing the report backs for each of the tables. And the reason for doing that is that I think what we did is we developed a very strong collective grassroots critical analysis of the curriculum that was centered on the experiences and the voices of youth in Milwaukee. And then we typed up the notes, of course, from that, and we distributed them, and then we started working. Everyone was very invigorated by that workshop and saw that this curriculum was something that needed to be stopped as soon as possible. And so we were all working through our own networks. At the same time, there had just been approved by the school board a Black Lives Matter resolution, and so there was a working group that was putting together a plan to implement that resolution, which required, building safe spaces for dialogue and efforts to dialogue specifically for Black students, and efforts to reverse the school-to-prison pipeline in Milwaukee. So we worked we did like sort of tag on, as Craig was saying, to other efforts that were going on in the city. We used social media to get people to show up to school board meetings and to testify about the STOP curriculum at the school board meetings. We also met separately with school board members and educated them about the problems with the curriculum. And then a few of us also worked internally, sort of like through more sort of reformist kind of approach, which was that the school board, in halting the program, had called for the Milwaukee Public School Administration to conduct an evaluation of the program. And so a couple of us were part of that evaluation. And so we were able to be on what was called the curriculum audit review of that evaluation, and so made a very big impact from the inside in making sure that the evaluation was going to not just recommend a revision of the program, but an actual complete stoppage of the program. So I think those are the variety of tools strategies that we used.
Awesome. Thanks, Lorraine. I believe we've been joined by Dolores Canales also. Is that right? Are you there, Dolores?
Yes. Hello, I'm here. I'm on BART, so I had it on mute.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to you. If you could just briefly introduce yourself and jump right in. The question that we're responding to is just to kind of start by sketching us a picture of the various strategies that you use through the course of the campaign that you're discussing today, kind of how you use grassroots mobilization, media, legislative or legal strategies, and giving us a sense of which of these strategies was most significant in your campaign.
Okay, yes, my name is Dolores Canales. I'm co-founder of California Families Against Solitary Confinement. And so the campaign that I'll be discussing was the movement, I guess, you know, to end solitary confinement and its use today, the indefinite use. And there was a number of strategies that we used. Well, first of all, we didn't even know we had strategies. So if I could just, you know, say that we are very, very grassroots. We family members started coming out when the hunger strike started in July of 2011. And so what I immediately started doing was, you know, just going up to people and asking them for their phone number. I mean, it's just, very basic. It's just introducing myself as a mother and asking people if they had a loved one inside, and then keeping everything on hard copy and little notes and who they had inside and what their relationship was and things like that. But then as we started organizing every other day, you know, rallies and things like that, we started connecting on a personal level as well. So we kept our, for us, we immediately got involved with other groups, but for our group, it is just family members. I mean, like, we don't have people say, oh, people are a part of us. I don't know how to really describe it, but for our group and everything we've done, we have a loved one inside. And so, you know, that has been the one thing that we continue to do, even as we continue on as a group, as an organization. And we immediately, the Bay Area, you know, they've been active for, like, I guess since they were born, practically everybody in the Bay Area. So, you know, as I started seeing the stuff they were doing on Facebook and in the paper, I started reaching out to different people from the Bay Area. So we got connected, like, on a Monday night coalition call. We used Facebook, emails, text messages, and just straight phone calls. For a lot of family members, you know, they're not going to check their email like maybe, you know, we do so often, or they're not going to do that. So it was very personalized with the family members. I mean, to where somebody had told me one time to buy this text blast system that's available, but the way that people responded to my text was because I individualized each text message, you know, asking them to come out and show up. And we really appeal to the pathos of society. I mean, as society has always judged the person in prison by the crimes that the most heinous crimes at that the society would say is what the media always portrayed. But then when you have family members, you know, just going up and telling their stories and even asking people, you know, what would you do? Even if you don't have somebody inside, what would you do? if it was your son or your daughter, whatever the family relationship is. And so we would rally in front of Sacramento. We would, protest in front of a building. We would, we started requesting assembly hearings and even being part of those panels and just getting involved on every level and, doing radio interviews, TV interviews, just everything that came along. It was, I don't think we had one particular strategy to really say, this is what we came up with. We still continue to be very grassroots. We still meet together. We go to Sacramento to CDC for regulatory hearings with the regulations that they're constantly imposing. Some of us have joined on the mediation team that was started by the ones inside as a go-between of communication as well with CDC. So this is just some of the various things that we've done, but we've remained very, very grassroots to the point to where we're all like family to each other. Having a family member inside out here, we also became family to each other. I just recently moved out to the Bay Area. Dorfman gave me a job, so I worked at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children as an organizer with All of Us Are None. So I think that's a really great opportunity. But some of the people on this call I met back in July of 2011 just because, just from people reaching out, making contacts and making connections. Another strategy that we used is, even though we're all in Southern California, is making sure that we had connections and family members in Northern California and Central California, and also working together. We have these yearly meetings where Northern California would come out and we'd have an all-day, strategy session, community outreach and things like that. So that's just some of the basic things that we've done. I mean, I thought I was just listening to the speaker before me. I didn't catch your name, but that's amazing. I can't even believe the school curriculum that was put forth that you were describing. And you're awesome. So I feel kind of inadequate for being on this call because we are like so ghetto and we're okay with it, though. That's who we are. We're just family members.
Thanks so much, Dolores. Before moving on to the next question, I just want to invite any of the panelists for any final thoughts about this question of strategy. I'm kind of struck, actually, in all of the comments that people made about how, in all cases, the strategies that emerge seem pretty organic. They're, to some extent, self-directed, but also lots of taking advantage of opportunities that came up along the way or connecting to other things already in progress. Does anyone have any sort of overarching thoughts that they want to add about this question of how we combine strategies and kind of why it's important to use a variety of strategies and also just kind of how these come together to shift common sense about community safety and well-being?
This is Lorraine. I guess one of the things that just really strikes me is each of these are locally based, relatively locally based campaigns, and just the importance of really knowing the local landscape, right? So in order to be able to, you have to develop allies or if that's not the best word, coalitions or connections to other groups who have similar agendas, right? Maybe not the same, maybe they're not focused. So in our case, we were focused on this particular curriculum, but it dovetailed extremely well with the folks who were promoting the Black Lives Matter resolution to reform the way education was being conducted in Milwaukee Public Schools, or those who are fighting against the takeover of Milwaukee Public Schools, by private forces. So, I think it's just really important to know to be very well connected locally and really know who else has similar kinds of analyses that you can work with.
One of the things that, hi, this is Craig, and you know, listening to Dolores talk about how, you know, people in her organization feel like family with each other reminded me of doing organizing in the prison towns in which people would say things behind closed doors. A lot of our meetings were in people's living rooms or in people's kitchens. People would say things behind closed doors but were afraid to go public with them. And there was a big, there was a lot of work that had to be done within those towns about how people could support each other if there was going to be a public confrontation with the powers that be in the town. And the levels of trust that were developed, that had to be developed and were developed among those local organizers were phenomenally high and were based very much on the sorts of things Dolores was talking about, that people got to know each other and know each other really well, really quickly.
If I could just say, this is Dolores, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. If I could just say really quick, I got dropped for a minute. You know, one of the things, though, that made definitely was the actions by those inside that now people were listening to our voice, but I think the immediate connections, July 2011 during the first hunger strike, we were embraced by so many groups that had already been doing this work for so long, you know, the attorneys, the organizers, you know, I think Jay was one of the first people that reached out to me for media, as a matter of fact, that, you know, nobody was, you know, so, you know, he heard what we were doing out there, and then, you know, when he got contacted, him and Molly, they immediately, you know, started saying, hey, you know, do this interview. So it was the connections and how we all, you know, collectively came together. I mean, right now, there's people in the Bay Area, you know, not just family members, that I can go and stay in their homes. I mean, so it goes, there's such a deeper connection. I mean, those feedbacks have remained very organic as far as, you know, family inside. The family, the extended family that we've now grown into in organizing is very powerful because, you know, I mean, even me being on this call, you know, so that I want to really push that, make that clear that I don't think this is something the family could have ever done on their own had it not been the collective power of many that, you know, have been doing this for some time or many that were willing to reach out and share their own resources. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. So we're going to shift slightly and talk a little more deeply about this question of coalitions. So obviously, in all three of you are discussing how important it is in order to effectively organize against the prison industrial complex often involves building coalitions of people who might not normally work together, right? So I'd like to ask each of the panelists to talk about the different organizations and people that were brought together through the course of the campaign and why or how such a broad coalition was important for moving the political goal forward, and also, if applicable, and it usually is, please feel free to touch on some of the challenges that come from organizing alongside unlikely allies. Lorraine, shall we go back to you?
Okay, sure. So in addition to the groups that I mentioned already, so those were, you know, youth, parents, community members, and educators, in terms of, and then the school board, the other, like, organizations, we also worked with the ACLU of Milwaukee and a nonprofit organization called Urban Underground. Urban Underground is a youth leadership organization dedicated to, like, building safe and sustainable communities through youth-led social justice campaigns. And the ACLU in Milwaukee has a number of what are called student alliances, which are high school, college, or law school clubs that promote civil liberties on campus. So neither one of these organizations is explicitly, you know, abolitionist, but they both had very strong critiques of the STOP curriculum, right, because the STOP curriculum was so horrible in only really centering the perspectives of police and not centering the perspectives of youth. And both of these organizations, the ACLU Milwaukee and Urban Underground, are focused on centering the perspectives and experiences of youth. So I think that so we worked with them. Like I said, I think in terms of the so in terms of why that's so important, I think we had to have a lot of different kinds of expertise in terms of critiquing the curriculum. It was valuable to have educators, you know, also critiquing it just from a kind of a even in terms of like layout and basic kind of skills of how a curriculum is put together, because those kinds of arguments were important at the level of the evaluation that was conducted, so that the school board halted the curriculum implementation pending an evaluation. And so it was really important that the evaluation come back when it comes back to the board, which is actually not yet come back, even though by all accounts the evaluation was completed. We didn't want, like I said earlier, that we didn't want the outcome of the evaluation to be a revised curriculum, because we saw the curriculum as absolutely and fundamentally flawed. So I think the challenge was to figure out how to make that happen and to be able to work on the kind of inside of the system to make that happen, right? To try to work with other educators who were supportive of police being in schools when we were not, but kind of to put that issue aside and focus for the time being on the curriculum, which we all agreed was problematic. So does that answer the question?
Thank you. Yeah, great. Craig?
Because, as I said before, I mean, one of the places we started from was the idea that prisons are bad for almost everyone, but they're not bad for different groups for the same reasons. And that was one of the big challenges in, we could get all kinds of groups to sign on to opposing the new prison, but we couldn't necessarily get them to work together. What we did do was actually help start three new organizations, two of which are still in existence. So there was Californians United for a Responsible Budget, which is mostly prison reform, anti-prison groups in California. There was Californians for Effective Public Safety, which was a Sacramento-based group that had civil rights groups, religious groups, some anti-prison groups, and was much more policy-oriented and kind of mainstream. You wore better clothes when you went to a SEPs meeting than when you went to a CURB meeting. And then the Central California Environmental Justice Network, in which we formed with a number of EJ groups in the Central Valley, whose goal was to stop the racist environmental damage in the Central Valley, including over-policing and prisons. So because all of these, we tried to show the different groups we worked with that fighting this prison kind of fit the agenda they already had, which then made it a challenge to get them to kind of step out of their routine and work with some of the other coalition members. But we organized some events in Sacramento in which we would have somebody from the SEIU and somebody from the UFW or the Center for Race, Poverty, Environment in Delano, you know, testify on the same panel. And they would bring their people with them, and there would be some mixing that way. We did some kind of skill sharing, teaching, training in Sacramento. One of our goals was to try to figure out kind of the question of scale. We wanted to be able to generate the power, the kinds of power that you can generate in local opposition in which people actually know each other, and can know each other on a daily basis, the sort of thing that Dolores was talking about, but also kind of ramp that up such that people in the legislators in Sacramento would be afraid of us because there were so many of us, because we represented hundreds of thousands of college students, we represented 500,000 state workers. And one of the challenges there, obviously, was, you know, the SEIU had paid lobbyists who had their lobby outfits and were really, you know, really very much at ease going into the Capitol and talking to people. And a lot of the grassroots people from the Central Valley towns and a lot of the college students and high school students didn't have that confidence and expertise. And so getting them to work together such that the power imbalance in our coalition was not, did not tear us apart or make us tip too much towards the union was a big challenge. But, you know, it was, I mean, it was successful enough that Californians for Effective Public Safety, for example, stopped, doesn't exist anymore because the, our funders found our politics too radical. And so, I mean, if you think that, you know, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Sacramento and the SEIU and the NAACP of Sacramento were too radical for some of our funders, is an indication of how we were able to, I think, move the politics of some of those organizations towards towards a politics in which any growth in the prison or policing system was seen as a threat to the well-being of their members. And the other thing that tore that apart was the election of Schwarzenegger and his attack on public sector unions, which then forced SEIU and the Prison Guards Union to publicly drop their feud. So SEIU didn't want to take on CCPOA publicly anymore. Okay.
Thank you. Dolores, did you want to add to this discussion of working with unlikely allies?
Yes, I just want to say that unlikely allies, CDC, of course, is a very was a very unlikely ally for us, but yet we were still, you know, being a part of the mediation team. That is meeting with CDC. When we requested a meeting with Jeffrey Beard, a face-to-face meeting, even though we knew we were going to get absolutely nowhere because he had already made the way he felt, I'm sorry, I just came and stood here with you guys because I saw what he was doing. And yeah, I can't believe that. I thought he's going to rob him right here. And you can't just do that to people. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm at BART. And so the thing is I'm here. I'm not going to leave until you guys are okay. I mean, I don't know what I could do either, but I'll freaking do something. No, he's back. He's gonna just rob people. You can't do that. And so even though we knew CDC, Jeffrey Beard, was not going to, you know, give in to anything, still looking at him in the face and showing him the, you know, the picture of cage-free chickens, you know, the humane standards for, you know, I blew it up in an 8x10 color copy, or requesting him to go spend the night in solitary confinement, as did several other CDC secretaries of state. So, you know, just different things that definitely unlikely allies. You know, I know meeting with conservative assemblies, they're the ones that always wanted to vote for more jails and more prisons. You know, so I think things like that, but, you know, I'm sorry, I can't think. I'm just seeing this man try to do something, and I just, oh, my gosh. Oh, God. He's just he's coming up to me now, so I'm going to go. Bye. God. Oh, my God. Oh, bye.
Okay. hopefully she's okay. Everyone else still with us?
What happened there?
I think something was happening with her at the BART station. Someone was approaching her with some sort of situation. That's what I was gathering. And she needed to hang up quickly.
We'll follow up with her after the call.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got her number. Cool.
Great.
Sorry.
So, Jess and Jay, we've got about 10 minutes left. We do have one final question we want to ask of the panelists, but I want to make sure there's time for them to ask questions of each other and also listeners to ask questions. So should we, what do people think? Should we move to open up the conversation or quickly get in our last question?
Well, let's see if anyone has a question now. So if you do, please speak. And if there's a bit of a silence, then we'll see if they have questions for each other or Melissa, that last one. Does anyone on the call, you're welcome to unmute yourself and ask questions of Lorraine or Craig about what you've heard so far. Cool. Well, let's take it to the last question then, and if there is time, please speak up. Or Craig or Lorraine, if you have questions for each other, let us know.
Okay, so the last thing we wanted to talk about is our deliberate prioritizing, developing, and amplification of the leadership of prisoners, former prisoners, young people, loved ones, in order to kind of shift within our organizing the common sense of who gets recognized as experts in the movement. And so we wanted to ask each of you to speak to that dynamic in the campaign you were part of and kind of how you changed who was seen as the expert to the extent that you did, and why, if this was important in your particular campaign, why was that important? Do you want to start, Lorraine?
Sure. So the as I think I mentioned earlier, the STOP program was the curriculum was really founded on the idea that youth were misinformed about the police, and that if the police just basically told them their point of view and showed them crime maps and other things, that they would understand why the police needed to continually stop people that looked like the youth in order to separate, you know, the good people from the bad criminals. That's kind of the narrative that the curriculum tells. And, of course, this curriculum erases the long history of police brutality, of documented over-policing, and other abuses that have been going on in Milwaukee by Milwaukee police. And it locates the source of the problem in kind of this lack of maturity of students. And so that if police would just, you know, teach students to understand why officers do what they do, that then the perception of police would change from being negative to being positive. So as I mentioned in the workshop, we centered, all of us in the workshop centered the numerous voices we had of youth who were presenting, you know, really sharp analyses of the curriculum that they were developing on the spot, analyzing the curriculum. And so we centered their, and they of course related their own experiences with police that weren't represented in the curriculum. And so we centered that, right? That was the evidence that mattered the most to all of us. And then in terms of publicly, like at the school board meetings, the youth also testified at school board meetings about what they saw as the problems with the curriculum, and also how it erased their experiences with Milwaukee police, their negative experiences with Milwaukee police that were not of their own making. So I think that covers what we did.
Great, thanks. Craig?
I guess the Delano 2 campaign happened so long ago that the first thing to say, I think, is that we have to fight to create space to have for anyone to have a voice. That is to say, the fact that the Department of Corrections wanted to build another prison wasn't a news story. It wasn't like somebody else was talking about it and we weren't, or people most affected weren't. No one was talking about it. So the first thing we had to do was actually create the space both in the legislature, you know, in terms of talking to legislators and their staff, and in terms of the media, that you could actually raise the question, why do we need another prison? What's it going to cost? What are we not going to fund if we're going to build and staff that prison? So that was a struggle for us. And I guess the first person I think that we sort of empowered to speak was Critical Resistance's staff person at that time, Rose Brabs, who became, you know, the media in Sacramento loved her because suddenly they had an expert on a topic they didn't realize was a topic. And, you know, the stories that they wrote were getting hits. They were getting lots of, you know, very mean letters from the prison guards and from the sheriffs. So they liked that kind of, you know, any kind of feedback is good feedback as far as the media is concerned. So we got more and more opportunities to speak and then face the challenge of, well, who should be speaking here? And there was a question kind of taking up the question of, well, what's not being funded if we're funding a prison? And getting people from prison towns, people from elementary school through graduate school, people who are in public housing, families who depended on TANF for other state payments to buy their food or get by month to month, that those people became, for us, the experts that we put forward on the cost of building a new prison. So they didn't have to know a lot about prison politics. What they did have to know was the state's taking money out of our program and using it to build a prison. And I guess the other thing I want to raise is that working both with the media and with some of the foundations, the Women's Foundation in particular was really good at funding issues around things that were going on in women's prisons. They were not interested in things going on in men's prisons. But we held up family members, female family members who had people inside men's prisons and said, you know, if there are 150,000 men locked up in prisons in California, there are probably somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million women outside whose lives have been terribly impacted by that guy being locked up. So we try to empower especially women family members to speak on behalf of the people inside.
Awesome. Thank you so much, both of you. Our time is almost up, but we probably have time for a question either from Craig to Lorraine, Lorraine to Craig, or someone else who's listening who would like to speak.
This is Jess. And a quick question I have is, what sort of ways did you communicate the victory or significance of your work so that it could be amplified outside of your city or region or stay in the memory of the folks in Milwaukee or communities in California beyond the end date, right, Craig? Like your work was almost 10 years ago now. And yeah. Lorraine, you're coming up on a year. So what did you do or what do you, reflecting back, what could you have done to imprint these victories or these lessons?
Lorraine, do you want to go first?
Sure. So ours is a little odd, actually, and in that the school board, as I said, suspended the program, which I think was largely due to our efforts. Then the evaluation never came back to us, or hasn't yet come back to the school board. So it's just remained halted. And then I think the evaluation, as far as I can tell, it was never released, but as far as we could tell, that it was not a positive one. And so the Milwaukee Police Department actually stopped pushing the curriculum. So they stopped putting pressure on MPS to deliver it. And so it's kind of, it's, you know, so then it sort of fizzled without having a definitive end. It is the report. So what we've been doing is trying to get the report to come back to the school board so that we can have the school board actually finally say that it will never implement this program. I would say it's an ongoing campaign still, and so it's not done. I think that we do want to build off this, though, because certainly the smaller group of us want to work to get police out of the Milwaukee Public Schools. So there are 50-plus what they call school resource officers in Milwaukee Public Schools, and we want that money to go towards restorative justice and other kinds of programming in the school. So I would say we're an ongoing campaign, and that our plans would be to leverage the analyses, the collective analyses that we've developed about the STOP program to work towards another campaign.
Right on. Thanks, Lorraine. Craig, anything to share from the Delano 2 fight?
At the time of the Delano 2 fight took 6 years, and the state tried to build other prisons in that time. So the first way that we kind of spread what we'd learned was drive around and talk to people. So, like, we were involved in campaigns from the far north of the state to the far south of the state, from Hurlong to El Centro, with towns that were fighting prisons, and doing outreach within the groups that we brought together in the coalition. So, for example, the teachers in the Bay Area took a resolution to the California Teachers Association, I think it is, and got them to pass a resolution condemning the school-to-prison pipeline in 2001 or 2 or 3, and then went to the National Education Association and not only got them to pass a similar resolution, but got them to develop a workshop to train teachers on how to teach about the school-to-prison pipeline in schools. So we've written a few little essays that are, you know, out and about. Ashley Hunt did a great film, not about the campaign, it was actually part of the campaign called A Prison in the Fields, which is still available and gives you a good idea of what we did in Delano. And, you know, I do regret that we didn't have the energy or the foresight or the time, really, to, like, sit down and kind of gather all of our documents together, interview each other or be interviewed by someone, such that there would be an archive that collected all that stuff, that someone, whether one of us or someone else, someone could use to document the campaign. But we were, we were exhausted at the end, and we weren't really the people to organize that. We needed someone with a fresh mind to force us to do that, and that person didn't emerge.
Or maybe hasn't yet.
yes.
Because these campaigns are still significant, right? As California is still a bit against the ropes with expanding prisons prolifically, but we're now facing jail. So you all are still around, and that's why we bring people together for these calls. A little bit of archiving is what we can offer here at the very least to start. So without much more, we're approaching or have reached the end of the hour. Is there anything people would like to add in closing? I have so much appreciation for all of you who presented and moderated today and who joined the call. Any last words from folks?
This is really insightful. Thanks so much.
Great.
Yes, thank you, and everyone out there, just keep up the fight.
Yeah, keep it going.
Right on. If you were listening to today's call or are listening to it on the website, please do let us know what you think, and if there's other topics that would be useful and of interest to learn more about critical resistance's history with being involved in this sort of work or our allies, because we've had the really humbling opportunity to work with amazing people along the way. And thank you, Lorraine, for calling in, and Craig and Melissa, and to all of our donors who make this work possible. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, all.
Thank you,
everyone.
Thank you.